NPRnewsHour.org. It's 9:07, and this is NHPR.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Today, on July 16th, 1969, the world watched a stunning American achievement unfold on TV.
Ignition sequence starts. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
The Apollo 11 rocket took off with three astronauts headed for the moon, and two of them walked on the lunar surface 4 days later, the first people to do so. And in addition to this Apollo anniversary, the moon has been on some folks' minds lately. All over New England this past weekend, many of us gazed at what's been dubbed the supermoon, a full moon that appeared unusually big and bright. And if you're wondering why that's the case, well, this hour on The Exchange, our sky guys are back to satisfy your lunar curiosity, as well as update us on all the latest astronomical news. So let's hear from you this hour. And first off, as we look back at the Apollo 11 launch, what are your memories of that day? Even if you're too young to remember the day itself, what do you think it signifies? The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter. Our sky guys are back with us. John Gianforte, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England and an astronomy instructor for Granite State College and UNH. His website is theskyguy.org. And John Gianforte, it's great to see you. Thank you.
Great to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Mal Cameron, longtime educator and former astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe-Shepard Discovery Center. And Mal, welcome back. Great to see you, too.
It's great to be here, as usual.
Well, let's talk about the Apollo 11 launch. Your memories, Mal, of that day.
I do remember watching that. And it's interesting, you watch it on TV, but what I remember is how slowly it lifted off from the launch pad because it was so heavy. This was the largest rocket ever built at the time. It still is, I guess. It was 363 feet tall with everything attached to it and a lot of weight to it. And it just, when it started to blast off, of course, there were so many people watching it there in person to see this historic event. And what I remember just thinking about the launches that I've seen a shuttle launch, and I've seen a launch of a couple of years ago of a probe that went to that's on its way right now to Jupiter, and that was just a capsule inside. That thing took off like a shot. And by comparison, the Saturn V rocket was almost in slow motion. And the big event happens when they say cleared the tower, because as it goes up, it kind of wavers a little bit. And one of their big concerns was that if it wavers too much, it could actually hit the tower, and that's the end of the mission.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
So it was a very stressful event. But, of course, we did it, and we got to the moon, and it was great fun. And we heard Neil Armstrong's famous stepping off of the limb and that sort of thing. Those of us who were around at the time, I think, will always remember it. I just remember looking at a black and white TV set that I had in our house at the time. It was just so much awesomeness about it. It was just hard to believe. And then when they got to the moon, to see the actual photographs and say, gosh, that's coming from, you could look at the moon in the sky and say, they're up there. They're walking around on that thing. It was just incredible.
Your memories, John.
I don't remember. I wasn't alive then.
Oh, come on, John.
No, I agree with Matt. It was a wonderful, just glued to the television, watching the launch, watching every moonwalk, sometimes even at late after bedtime when I was a kid watching, just transfixed by the astronauts moving around, working on the moon, which I had looked at many, many times at that time with a small telescope, just wondering in amazement about there, you know, three people up there, two on the moon and one orbiting below them, worried about them getting back to the command module with the ascent stage of the lunar module, just great memories of all the Apollo missions.
Well, and John, I'm glad you mentioned that because I've always wondered about that third guy. I mean, the two guys that are on the moon, they're making footprints, they're making statements that will be, you know, heard forever, one small step, et cetera. What about that poor third guy? Why couldn't he get on the moon?
Well, there's got to be
some... Go all the way there and you can't touch down. Seems a little unfair.
I don't think he felt Mike Collins. I don't think he felt cheated or in any way because someone has to drive the bus. And it takes at least one person in the lunar module on its way up and someone piloting the command module to make sure it's in the right position while they're mating again so that people on the moon can get back into the main spacecraft. It takes a team, and I'm sure he was concerned about them getting back up. That was probably occupying his most of his attention and thoughts.
Mal.
Yeah, he had a lot to do up there, and I can't speak for Mike Collins, but a few years ago when I was at Cape Canaveral in the Kennedy Space Center, they had an astronaut encounter with the command module pilot of Apollo 15. His name, last name is Waldron, and I forgot his first name. But he was talking and about the experience of going to the moon, and he mentioned that very thing. What do you feel like when those two guys are going to the moon and you're stuck
exactly.
up there? He says, are you kidding? I got rid of two extra people. And I had this whole capsule all to myself. It was like moving into a mansion or something. I could do whatever I wanted, and they were
great.
On the moon doing their stuff. He says, I loved it. So I don't
Peace
know if
and
Michael,
quiet.
Yeah.
Well, I'd love to get your memories of that day as well. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. We're spending a little time today with our Sky Guys looking back 45 years ago when Apollo 11 made its launch and a couple days later landing on the moon. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. So, John, what was the push behind this? Just remind us, why did the powers that be 45 years ago think that it was important to send some guys up to the moon?
Well, it was to fulfill a challenge that President Kennedy made to the nation and to the world and to show our mastering of technology, superiority of the economic way, capitalism over communism.
The Cold War era.
It was all about politics and who can do what first. And the Soviets had many, many, many firsts in space, and this was a huge one. And they were much, much closer than we realized at the time to launching a manned mission to the moon.
Oh, so they were working on it,
they
too.
They were only weeks behind. And in fact, when the first people were on the moon, there was a Soviet spacecraft on the way to the moon. Now, it wasn't manned, but that was they were trying to at least steal some of the thunder of the Apollo 11 mission. But that's what it was about. It was about competitiveness, one-upsmanship, much more of that than about science. And
that's really interesting. And we forget how important that was. Mal, do you want to jump in? I have another question for you.
What's really interesting is on May the 5th of 1961 is when our own New Hampshire's own Alan Shepard became the first American in space. And just a little, he didn't even go into orbit. He just went up into space, came back down. And
but it was a big
took
deal.
Him 15 minutes. And within just a few weeks of that flight is when President Kennedy came out with that statement that by the end of the decade, we're going to go to the moon, all based on that one successful flight. It was incredible, and it was incredibly hard. And that's what he said in one of his speeches. We go to the moon not because it's easy, but because it's hard. And boy, did we learn a lot in the process, technologically and philosophically, and, of course, the idea was beat the Russians, which we did.
Well, speaking of something being hard, in a ceremony marking the anniversary, John, NASA's administrator made it quite clear that the agency wants the next big voyage to be to Mars. And he said, we're getting there, small step by small step. What are some of those small steps that we're taking? Because right now it seems very far away.
Well, it does. I'm not sure that there's enough momentum behind his words to get us there. When President Kennedy made the challenge of the statement that we are going to the moon and it's hard, but we're going to do it anyway. I mean, you just wanted to make that happen.
Everybody was on board with that.
Yes. And unless we do a better job of explaining why we should go to Mars, why we should care about Mars, it's got to gain some momentum before the public really takes hold and that's what's going to help the missions happen. Right? There's a lot of good reasons to go to Mars, and a lot of them are political and social and cooperative. It's a great way to foster international cooperation. I think that's probably the best fundamental insurance policy for the human species, is to find out how we can work together doing something hard, important, and exciting. But there's a lot of great science to be learned. When we explore other planets, like Mars, we don't not only learn about those other planets, but we also learn more about our own planet. And to survive, you need to know your own neighborhood better. And you can do that by studying other planets.
What do you think, Mal? John's making a case for going to Mars, but he's right. There doesn't seem to be this big public yes, we can behind a mission to Mars.
Yeah, it's interesting, I find, that when you talk about space missions, it seems that the public is more interested in the people missions. Somebody has to be on board a spacecraft to make it interesting enough. In spite of all the robotic spacecraft that we've sent out to far-reaching planets, we've looked at all of the, well, now called regular planets. We'll get into that later, maybe, but they don't seem to be as excited about those, except maybe for the Mars missions, because they can follow those very easily. And I just think it's just a far-reaching thing we have to go to, and whether we get there or not, who knows?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the Mars missions, because coming up, there's an update on the Mars Curiosity rover that I need to ask you guys about. Also, we'll look at the science behind the supermoons and when we'll see more of them. Check out our Facebook page. Listeners have already posted their supermoon photos there. You can post yours, too. All that's coming up. We'll be right back.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. An HPR summer car raffle has begun. We're giving away some great prizes, including a new car later this summer. Get your tickets today to put your name in the hat for the early bird prize. So, $2,000 in Irving Oil Gas gift cards. And if you're the winner, your name goes back in the hat for the other prizes, too. But only when you get your raffle tickets at nhpr.org. Flash flood watch remains in effect statewide through this evening. Showers, a chance of thunderstorms today. Locally heavy rainfall possible. Humid highs today in the upper 70s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Mark Knipe Goldsmiths at 2 Capitol Plaza, downtown Concord, completing most jewelry repairs in-house using laser technology appropriate for even the most delicate jewelry. And from Southern New Hampshire University's doctoral program in educational leadership for professionals ready to lead schools into the 21st century. snhu.edu/edd. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with our Sky Guys about the latest astronomical news, ranging from the 45th anniversary of the Apollo 11 launch to the moon, putting the first men on the moon. We've talked about that. In a moment, we'll look at what's been happening with the Mars rover Curiosity. And a little later on, a global scientific body invites the public to vote on names for newfound planets. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And here's an email, gentlemen, that came in from Lori, who says, on that day, meaning the day Apollo 11 launched, I asked for people's memories earlier. Lori says, on that day, I had a summer job in a nursing home in Florida. Staff and residents were glued to the TVs watching the astronauts walk on the moon. So this was a couple days later when they walked. Lori says, to a person, none capitalized of the residents thought that this was really happening. They all thought it was a movie. Lori, that's great. Thank you so much for the email. John, what do you think? There was sort of an aura of unreality about this.
You know, it reminds me of a scene from the movie Apollo 13 when they interviewed who was the commander of that mission, who was driving, who was landing, the flying, who was head of that mission, and he said if they could make a washing machine fly, if they could make a washing machine fly, he could land it. So, I mean, it's
feeling pretty confident about his
abilities. She was, and she was an elderly woman, but was very cognizant that it certainly wasn't a movie, because it was her son that was on the aborted mission to the moon. So hopefully most Americans now know that the moon missions were real. They did happen. And now that we have other international missions to the moon that have been to the moon and taken pictures of the spacecraft and the footprints left behind, it's no secret that it really did happen.
All right, and let's get some more memories from our listeners. Jerry's calling in from Newcastle. Hi, Jerry, you're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning, everybody. Yeah, I just had a wonderful family story. We in 1969, my grandfather, who was born in 1890, was in Southern Illinois. We lived in Chicago. Went down to visit him to show the new great-grandchildren off. And we arrived, and he was very, very serious. And he said, "I have to talk to you about something very serious." And I figured major family crisis of some type. No, instead he said, "I watched the thing about the moon. Is it true?"
So kind of relating to Lori's email, Jerry, just people couldn't believe it.
Wow.
Yeah, he says, "Is it true?" He says, "When the Wright brothers flew, I didn't believe it for a year."
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Yeah, he remembers all that. And then World War One and World War Two, and he said, "This has to be a Hollywood stunt." I said, "No, I believe it's true."
Wow. Even and in the so days before photoshopping and things like that, Jerry.
Yeah. And so it was just amazing, because I was convinced something was really wrong. You know, uh-huh. His farm was being foreclosed or something, but instead he wanted to know the truth.
That's a
Jerry,
great story.
Thank you so much for calling in. That's great. And let's go to Dan in Epsom. Hi, Dan. You're on the exchange with the Sky Guys.
Hi. Listen, you guys talk about this. It brought back memories, because I remember all of us, the time I was a kid in Atlanta, and we were watching this on our black and white TV. And our cousins, I remember from South Carolina on my mom's side, called us to make sure we were watching this. But the level of excitement was really like nothing I can remember in my entire life, really. Just as we knew they were about to touch down, I remember finally as you saw a camera shot out the window at the lunar surface, but you could finally see the flames, I guess, or the thrusters reflecting off of the surface, and then suddenly they were down, and Walter Cronkite, I remember they went to him, and you could see the tension in him suddenly just dissolve, and he just said, "Well, man on the moon," you know. But that was such an extraordinary moment, I have to say. One other thing about the Mars mission, forgive me if I'm a naysayer, but I really wonder that why would it be worth it when we have had all those rovers up there for so long telling us so much about the planet, and then just the sheer length of time, what's about 6 months one way?
It's about 9 months, I think,
nine
Dan.
Months. Oh,
yeah.
Grief. Okay.
So, Dan, let me push you a little bit if I could, and I really appreciate your call. So the excitement of landing on the moon, it's great, and yet Mars, you're going, eh. Never mind. How come?
It's not never mind. It's just, okay, the potential problems for such a long space flight voyage. I'm retired Air Force, so I would always have the NASA channel on at my site, and I was always seeing the guys up in the space station. And you saw the limitations that were posed on them by being in space for long periods of time. For instance, they had to work out daily with these, like big rubber bands, mm-hmm. because they lose, they say, more bone mass, I don't know what exactly, how short a time limit is per month, I think, than postmenopausal woman does in a year, something like that. It's like they have to keep doing all these things to retain bone mass. I mean, there's other physiological issues, but
all sorts of physical, mental, financial challenges. So I'm glad Dan called, because let's talk about this a little bit more. I know you want to jump in, John. Mal, you too. Again, excitement about the moon, but Mars, some people are probably feeling it's too much.
Well, there's a lot going on as far as going to the moon is totally different. It's in the neighborhood. You can see it all the time. Mars, sure, it's way out there in the night sky, but it looks like a little red dot. The problem with Mars is it's not like being on the Earth. There's so little atmosphere to it, very, very thin atmosphere. But also there's no magnetic field around Mars. So you're exposed to a lot of radiation from the sun. Even en route to Mars, you have to protect your spacecraft. You have to have special spacesuits. If you ever wanted to put a habitat on Mars, that would have to have extra protection on it for the astronauts. Everywhere you go on Mars, you need to wear a spacesuit. It's very, very difficult and extremely expensive, too, of course.
So take all the problems with the moon missions and magnify them many times.
Well, but
over.
The one thing I think is that when you're going to Mars, the big reason for going that I hear is, first of all, we're going to get people there to get the general public excited, as we talked about earlier. But also the concept is that they can move faster and think faster as to what to pick up, what to look at. They just walk over and pick it up. Whereas with a rover, they go very slow. They move very slowly on the surface because they can't go very fast because of the distance involved in controlling it.
And every movement, every decision, quote unquote, is
right.
Calculated and directed from, you know.
But we're learning a lot from the rovers. Obviously, we've already know that, you know, the basis of Mars and what we're dealing with, and that's part of prepping to send people.
Yeah, as our caller notes, we're learning a lot from these rovers. Go ahead, Matt.
The top speed of the rovers is 5 centimeters per second. You can't walk that slow.
Right.
So rovers, even though we've had great success with orbiting spacecraft, rovers, and stationary spacecraft on Mars, and we've learned a tremendous amount about Mars, it's really the planet we know the most about except for the Earth. There's nothing more exciting. One thing the rovers can't do, even though they can move, is imagine yourself, Dan, walking down a dried river valley where water once flowed on Mars. You're walking down this valley with your partner, and you see an odd-shaped rock, a small odd-shaped rock. So you tap your partner on the shoulder, you go over and investigate, you pick it up, and what you find is a fossil. Rovers would be very hard-pressed to do that. So we're going to Mars to look for evidence of life, and humans are the best kind of entity to have on the surface of another planet to make those in-situ decisions as to which rocks to pick up, throw, investigate, bring into the spaceship for a closer look. Rovers, robotic spacecraft, can't do that yet.
Well, Dan, thank you for the call. I love your memory, and I appreciate the point. It's worth talking about because
definitely.
You're right. This is a big, big, big deal. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And if you're at our Facebook page, you can look at some of the cool pictures that our listeners have posted of the supermoon, Mal Cameron, that we saw this past weekend. It was beautiful. What made it so super?
Filled the big hole. It was so much bigger. Wow. I did go out and look at it, and it of course, it does look very big.
Very bright.
Very bright. And you said, well, is it? Maybe it's a little bit bigger. And I think what happens is that the hype about super moon, I don't think it was I didn't see a big S on it when it was rising. so I'm not sure. But it was very pretty, and technically it was slightly larger because it was closer. And that's what causes the so-called supermoon, because when the moon is orbiting the Earth, it's not a perfect circular orbit, as none of the planets are either, though Venus comes very close to that. But as the moon orbits, it's an ellipse. So one part of its orbit is closer to the Earth, and the opposite side of that orbit is further away. The part that's closest to the Earth is called perigee, if you want to get technical here. When the moon becomes full near perigee, then the moon is going to be closer and much brighter, course, with the full moon with the sun shining on it. And that's really what creates this so-called supermoon. The one we just passed last week was not the biggest. The biggest actually comes next month in August, on August the 10th. And the reason for that is because it is coming to be technically full at within the hour that it hits perigee.
The absolute closest point to the Earth. Oh, that's great, though.
So that's going to be even a little bit bigger. If you liked the last one, wait till you see the one in August.
Hope it's not raining.
No guarantees there.
What do you think, John? Too much hype over the supermoon or not?
Well, any excuse to get people out looking at a moon is okay with me.
Absolutely.
But the moon wasn't super. And if no one told you that it was a super moon, you probably would not have noticed it. Because my wife and I were driving on Friday night, the day before, and the moon was rising in the east. It was a beautiful night, and that moon looked super. But it was just a little bit closer than it normally is on the actual instant of the full moon. So as Mal said, it looked a little bit bigger. And since it's closer, it's a little bit brighter. So I'm all for getting people out to look at the moon, but it really wasn't super. Beautiful, maybe, but not super.
Okay, and it'll be super on August 10th, Mal says.
Right.
Yes, and also the September full moon, which it takes place on the 8th, will also be a little bit bigger than normal as well.
All right. Well, and it's appropriate that we have a super moon with this 45th anniversary of the Apollo 11 launch. Did you want to jump in there, Matt?
Yeah, I was just going to say, if we could add real quickly here, what makes the moon look really big, especially when it rises, is something called the moon effect, I guess, is that it always looks very big on the horizon compared to when it's up in the sky. And everybody wonders, why does it look so big? And the moon illusion comes from the idea that when you're looking at the moon as it rises, you're looking through trees and houses in the front and forefront against the moon. And in your brain, it makes the moon look bigger. But here's a trick that I found really works. If you see the moon rising and you want to test this out, hold your arm out at arm's length and put your thumb up over the moon with, you know, blink one eye and try to hold it over the moon. Try to get an idea of how big that looks to you against your thumb. And then give it a couple hours later and hold it up to the sky and do the same thing.
When the moon is higher.
When the moon is higher. And or wait 3 or 4 hours if you want. And where there are no trees or houses in the foreground. And you will see that that thumb is going to cover it pretty much the same way.
Interesting. All right, I'll try that on August 10th, if it's not raining, which I hope it will not be. Let's go back to our listeners again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Audrey's calling from Grantham. Hi, Audrey. You're on the exchange with the Sky Guys. Go ahead.
Good morning, Laura. I wanted to tell you what our family did when the broadcast came from the moon. We had 3 young children at that time. And we decided we wanted them to know where they were when they heard the broadcast. We were living in the New York metropolitan area, and we took them into New York to the American Museum of Natural History. We went to the gem room, and we had a transistor radio, which would work in the gem room because the gem room still had windows in it in those days. Not only did our family listen, but everybody around did too, including the guards in the gem room. We heard the broadcast there. And to this day, my 55-year-old son remembers where he was that day.
That's wow. Great. Thanks a lot, Audrey, for calling in. That's wonderful. Yeah. And it's cool to hear people's stories of what they were doing on the day of the launch, which, again, was today. In fact, looking at the clock, it's 9:35. And as I understand, Mal, the launch was at 9:32 or something.
9:32. So it's on its way.
On its way. And then 4 days later, landing on the moon. You know, guys, while we're talking about, with the moon launch, NASA this, NASA that. But things have changed, John Gene 40, and now NASA is outsourcing a lot of its work to private companies. A couple interesting projects going on, being conducted by private interests. But just real broadly first, what's this move about, John?
Well, it's about cost. If people realized what a small percentage of our GDP goes into NASA's budget, it's approximately 0.5%. People envision it being much larger. If you also consider how much money is eventually returned to the economy as a result from all the new products and new technologies that are developed to function and travel and exist in space, no one would question that space is a good investment for the future. But the orbital sciences, SpaceX companies that are now partnering more and more with NASA, even using NASA facilities under contract, is a way that NASA is combating a decreasing budget in the face of disagreement in Washington as to how to spend our money.
So that's the policy. What about on the substance, John? I mean, will the missions be as good? Will they have more problems? You know, sometimes there's a lack of communication among, you know, contractor and agency. What do you think?
There'll be a lot of that. Dealing with contractors is difficult because they have different motivations than a government agency. So that will have to be watched. In the long run, I think if we can allow NASA to take the dominant and leading role in space exploration and safety and act as consultants for this burgeoning industry, I think we'll be okay. If we allow NASA to spend its budget, its money on science, exploration, and getting that knowledge into the hands of the public and into the economy, that might not be a bad way to spend their money. And plus, it might bring about space tourism, safe space tourism, a lot quicker by getting other companies involved, because now there's a profit motive there.
Well, and NASA is out of the shuttle business, as we've talked about on this program before. So, Mal Cameron, a private company is basically acting like a space UPS truck, bringing stuff up to the International Space Station.
It's a hired delivery service, basically, in this case, delivering supplies to the International Space Station. So we have two companies that are active doing that. One of them that got the head start has sent up, I think, three at the time, was SpaceX. They're located out in California. They're owned by Musk?
Elon Musk.
Elon Musk, who also owns the Tesla company and all that. And then the other company is this Orbital, which just sent up theirs this past weekend. So they're both sort of competing against each other as well.
All right. Well, coming up, we'll get John to update us on the number of extrasolar planets that have been found. And we'll hear about a cool new project getting the public involved in the game of Name That Planet. We'll find out more in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, understanding the Export-Import Bank and calls to abolish it. Then concerns about safety and regulation of dietary supplements. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
This morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. There's a flash flood watch in effect for across the state through this evening. Showers, a chance of thunderstorms for today. Locally heavy rainfall possible. Humid, high temperatures in the upper 70s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and Historical Society of Cheshire County in Keene, featuring Canvassing the White Mountains, Icons of Place, 47 paintings of the White Mountains and Mount Monadnock by 19th and 20th century artists. And from Dartmouth-Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare, a sustainable system improving the health of our communities for generations to come. Imagine.d-h.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we'll talk about Americans' struggles with stress. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. Today, we're getting an update with our Sky Guys on the latest news from outer space and the many reasons why we should be looking up in the night sky. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us with your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. John Gene Forty's with us, along with Mal Cameron. And gentlemen, let's go right back to our listeners. And Bill's calling in from Milford. Hi, Bill. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You had a caller earlier who commented that he was a little uneasy about us going to Mars. I would like to explain to the audience why we should go to Mars.
All right.
I invite people to look out their window and see if they see any dinosaurs. I guarantee they will not. The reason for that is that the dinosaurs never went to Mars. the thing that happened to the dinosaurs is going to happen again, and if we humans do not have self-sustaining colonies at locations elsewhere than on this planet, we will go the way of the dinosaurs. It's as simple as that. You have to look at the long-term picture, survival of the human race, and I invite the listeners to check the NASA website. They have articles on terraforming Mars. That's the only planet in this solar system where that might be possible. The people that wrote those articles are not stupid, so they have to be taken seriously. And that would be the long-term guarantee of survival for the human race.
Well, Bill, it's great to hear from you. And John, do you want to jump in?
I have to say, Bill, the reason that the dinosaurs became extinct was because that their near-Earth asteroid exploration program was grossly underfunded.
In other words, they didn't quite suspect that there was an asteroid coming and have time to blow it up.
That's right. So I agree completely with you. That's a great reason, and it may seem premature going to Mars, but it's really not. So that's an interesting perspective, and thanks.
Well, Bill, thanks for calling in. It reminds me, Mal Cameron, that we've talked about asteroids on our show before, you know, the specter of one of them threatening us, as they sometimes do in the movies. I think the European Space Agency has a mission coming up, not to an asteroid, but to a comet, to actually go to a comet and check it out.
Absolutely. This has been going on for about 10 years now since it was launched. It's called the Rosetta mission, and sounds like the Rosetta Stone, I guess, because they hope to interpret a lot about comets as a result of this. But this is a tricky thing. Every time I hear about these missions, these engineers, I think, are nuts. But they challenge themselves completely. This has taken, it's chasing a particular comet that they just call 67P, because normally they'll put the names of the comet discoverers on there too, but they're really long names and very hard to pronounce. So they call it 67P. This was launched in March of 2004. And next month is when it is going to finally encounter, in August, this comet. It has taken a very circuitous route to get there because we've done flybys. They do a lot of gravity assist flybys using the planets.
Well, and comets are moving quickly.
Yes, they are.
You got to hit it right.
And so they have to get to the trajectory. But here's the trick. Here's a moving object coming in toward the sun, speeding toward the sun, and it'll wrap around the sun late next year. And what they want to do is put this Rosetta spacecraft in orbit around this moving comet.
So is it going to land on the comet, Mal?
Well, there is. That comes this fall. There is a little lander called Philae, I guess it's P-H-I-L-A-E. And it's going to drop this off in November and hopefully land it on the nucleus of the comet.
As it approaches the sun and makes its closest approach.
Right.
That's a very carefully thought out mathematical equation.
Yes, and what they found out recently, I just read an article recently, is that as the spacecraft approaches this comet, they found that it is a double comet. Its nucleus is actually a contact binary, which means there's two nuclei very close together, which makes landing on it a lot more difficult because these two small pieces, like just a couple of kilometers each, are revolving around each other. So it makes it a lot more complicated dynamically instead of it was just a single object.
Well, while we're talking about the Europeans, I just have to quickly note this story about European astronauts in particular have complained about the quality of the coffee on the International Space Station. If you've been to Europe, you know why. The
coffee
is good
there.
It was the Italians.
Yes, it was.
And John, thanks to the Italians, grazie, I guess. I don't speak Italian. They're going to fix this.
They have. They have an IS espresso machine.
An espresso. ISS for International Space Station.
That's
espresso.
Right. Okay. And they have been complaining about the coffee in space. And I would complain, too. I think that's an important part of daily life. And if people are going to be working up there, they ought to have a nice refreshment.
So they're going to get their first espresso machine. Again, ISS. And this comes in conjunction with the first female Italian astronaut coming up. So just in time
There's
for her.
There's the reason right there. Yes.
Give Italian. The woman a nice cup of coffee.
Right.
And it's
right.
an Italian company
Otherwise,
that's been working
she won't
on this.
Go.
Well, I just wanted to take note of that. And let's go back to our listeners. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. And to Amherst, George is on the air. Hi, George. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Thanks. I wanted to tell you guys about one of my most vivid memories as a kid when that July day when Neil Armstrong stepped down onto the moon. I was in Ocean City, Maryland with my dad, who was a very stoic, silent, strong, stern Texan. I turned to him, and he was sobbing with tears rolling down his cheeks. It was the first time I'd ever seen him cry, and it startled me. It wasn't until decades later that I really found out why. He was a microwave radar engineer for Bendix Corporation. As it turns out, I found that all this out on his deathbed last Christmas Eve.
Oh, my goodness.
That he was the engineer that led the team that built the first radar to track the Sputnik satellite. He worked on the telemetry system for the Gemini space program.
Wow.
He designed the fusion, the target acquisition radar for the Patriot missile system, and he was working on the space shuttle telemetry on that July day. And so I finally, after years, figured out that he was in a really unique position to understand the science behind the mission and what Neil Armstrong really meant when it was, one giant leap for mankind. Dad got a real grip on that. We had a great talk the night before he died about this.
Oh, my
That's
gosh,
really
George.
Special.
Thank you so much. Now, how old were you, George?
Well, let's see. That was July 1969.
Right.
I just turned 60, so I was 15 years old. I was born in 54. My dad took us out on the dock on a place on Winnipesaukee in 1957 and pointed out Sputnik as it went overhead for the first time. And he didn't tell us why it was important, and I found out, 50 years later,
wow.
that he was the guy that knew why it was going to be where it was.
Yeah, a lot of people born in the 1950s remember Sputnik,
yes.
and that gets to what you talked about earlier, John, that the moon exploration by the U.S. had to do, in large measure, to that Cold War competition. Oh, George, so glad you called.
That
what a great story.
Knocked us out of our complacency back in 57.
All right. Well, thank you again. For the call, George. And here's an email that came in from Aubrey. She says, I'm a middle school science teacher. Does anyone have a good suggestion of a comprehensive astronomy book for eighth grade students, about 13 years old? Aubrey says, it doesn't need to be a textbook, but I'm hoping to integrate physics and astronomy in an interesting way at an appropriate level. She says, many books are either too elementary or too complex. It's a good point. There's a lot of fun space books for little kids, and then you've got college textbooks. But either of you guys have an idea for what's in between?
I would recommend reading the book Cosmos, published in 1980 by Carl Sagan. It is one of the best, I would consider it the best science book ever written. And it also has a little bit to do with astronomy. So it has a lot of good science. And when you teach students about astronomy, you touch every other science. Meteorology, physics, physical science, earth science, chemistry, biology, everything. And that book includes it all.
All right. Well, Aubrey, thanks for the call, the email. Let's take a call. This is Blythe in Henniker. Hi, Blythe. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I live in Henniker. I teach at Brady, and I'm the Brady rep to Concord Reed. And we were meeting yesterday. This year, the book is going to be Dan Winter's The Last Policeman. And that deals with an impending asteroid coming at the Earth and destroying civilization and how people respond to that. And, we're hoping that we're going to have lots of programs for the community, and we're hoping maybe that you would even consider doing one of your programs on the skies. On that in March when Dan Winter, the author, is here.
That's The Last Policeman. I've heard of it. It's a book about Concord, Blythe. And this is an asteroid is coming, and everybody says to heck with it, and they're behaving very badly. And this last policeman says, no, no, we need to keep going on in an ethically appropriate
right.
way. Yeah,
and that's what happens. We're going to be looking at the ethics, the morals, the, how do people behave? What do we need to know? And again, probably looking at what can we do to be prepared if something like this does happen?
Well, Blythe, thanks a lot for calling in. And that book actually did get some coverage on National Public Radio as well, mm-hmm. The Last Policeman. So
I wrote it down. I haven't read that.
Yeah, yet. No, it sounds terrific. Blythe, thank you so much for calling in. Let's take another call if we could. And this is Rodney in Northwood. Hi, Rodney. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. I'd like to tell you a little story quickly. About 10 years ago, my granddaughters and I went down to the Christa McAuliffe Planetarium. I don't think it's called that anymore. But anyway, there was nobody there. It was only us and another couple. And he asked if anybody wanted to see anything. And I said, I've always wondered why the North Star never moves. So he went into his magic cubicle there and popped it up. And we watched all the stars go around, and it was really fantastic. And the kids go, wow, this is fantastic, you know, because we sail, and we're always looking for the North Star when we do it.
Oh, Ronnie, that's great. Thank you so much. Mal, go ahead. You used to work at the McCullough Shepherd Discovery Center for many years.
We used to love doing it. I love playing with the toys there because the computer system they have is really fun. But, yeah, I remember doing that, and we would spin the sky around and bring the north to the front so everybody could see it. And I remember those days very well. It's all kinds of fun. I remember one time doing a show and somebody, we were talking about the North Star and how to find it, did that little trick. And then somebody said, well, is there a South Star? So I said, oh, let's find out. And on the fly, we could just go to the Southern Hemisphere and have a look. And the
answer, is there one?
The answer is no. Nothing that you would see. I mean, there. If you had a big, powerful telescope, you might find a little tiny dot there, but nothing that is more naked eye. You have to use a little reckoning to find south when you're down there.
Well, speaking of little tiny dots, I want to ask about little tiny dots that we can't even see. And John Gene, for you know what I'm going to ask. Extrasolar planets. Again, these are the planets that scientists have detected, not seen, but detected outside our solar system, orbiting other stars, in other words, other suns. And boy, every couple days, a new one is detected or discovered. What's the number at now?
Well, it's funny you should mention it, introduce the topic quite that way. I'll tell you that the total number of extrasolar planets that have been confirmed, not just speculated upon, but confirmed, is 1,810. And those 1,810 planets are orbiting in 1,125 different systems. 466 of those systems are known to be multiple planetary systems, which means they have more than one planet in them. And
just like ours.
That's right. We haven't found a dual for our solar system yet, but we're pretty new at this stuff. But one of the things that caught my ear when you just introduced the topic that way is because now our technology has gotten so good and astronomers are getting better and better at finding, detecting, and seeing extrasolar planets.
So can we see some of them?
We've imaged 50 extrasolar planets at the present time. That means we've actually seen them. Now, we can't see them as big disks and know how many continents they have, if they have trees. But we know that we have seen them. We are beginning to be able to interrogate their atmospheres. We can detect if they have an atmosphere around them. And we can even tell you what kind of gases make up the atmosphere of these planets.
That's amazing because they're so far away.
Yes, it is amazing. And we have to give the astronomers a lot of credit for the different techniques that they're using to find them and then to study them in detail.
Well, speaking of new planets that are being discovered, next year the public is going to get a chance to vote on its favorite names for newly found planets. The International Astronomical Union, the IAU, has announced, Mal Cameron, the new naming project called Name Exo Worlds. We've got a link on our website to it as well. Now, why is this such a big deal? How has naming been done before? Was it sort of a only the elite can name and now anybody can have a shot at it?
There were committees that worked on it. For example, if we actually have our own solar system, if you look at the names of our planets, they're all based upon Roman gods. some of the other names, I guess. I don't know where they come from, some of these names, but they're personal pet names from some people. Like if you get out into what's called the Kuiper Belt, which is where Pluto resides, and now Pluto has been, of course, decided that it's a Kuiper Belt object, but a
demoted.
Minor.
That's
demoted.
Still
yes.
Rankles some people, but
yes,
we won't go there
does.
Right now.
It does, but anyway. On these extrasolar planets, I'm not sure if there is a system. Is there?
There is. Oh, definitely, there's a system. Yes, I mean the right now the planets that have been discovered have very unromantic names, like Kepler 22e. So they're named. They have a catalog designation, but the IAU has decided to make the public now, beginning in this fall and ending next year, in a program that will allow the public to vote on the names of 20 to 30 of the best characterized extrasolar planets.
Well, maybe one of them, relating to the music we're hearing, will be named Hal.
There you go.
Or Dave.
Or Dave.
I'm just going to leave it at that.
Or what about John? I mean,
or John. Know. Or John. Guys, it was really fun to see you. Thank you so much, Mal. Thank you.
Thank you for asking us.
Mal Cameron, longtime educator, former astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center. John Gianforte, thanks for your time as always.
My pleasure. A lot of fun as usual.
John Gianforte, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England and an astronomy instructor for Granite State College and UNH. His website, by the way, is theskyguy.org. The Exchange is a production of NHPR, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, struggling with stress. From major challenges like chronic illness or financial problems to minor annoyances like traffic jams or inconsiderate neighbors, stress affects us all. For some, it can be overwhelming, while others find ways to cope and even use it to their advantage. In connection with the NPR series on this, we'll explore the latest thinking on stress. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and from Comcast Business, continuously investing to keep customers ahead of the technology curve. Comcast Business is built for business. More at business.comcast.com. And from Campo Inateca, a contemporary Italian wine bar featuring fresh pasta, artisan bread, charcuterie, and small plates, Elm Street, Manchester, online at campoinateca.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. The U.S. Export-Import Bank was created in 1934 by President Franklin Roosevelt to increase trade with the Soviet Union. Now an independent agency, the bank boasts a $140 billion portfolio made up of loans